Welcome back to Alaska Voices. In this episode, we'll focus on the theme of fieldwork. We're featuring conversations that share many different threads, including successes and failures in the field, animal encounters, and early inspirations.
Scientists who are just starting out often have this infectious curiosity they bring with them to the field. That's particularly true when experienced researchers get the chance to see their field sites from a child's perspective.
What I like about this conversation is that it's clear that Merity, Jeremy's daughter, is so bright and engaged with learning about nature. When I hear her talk, I think she's an amazing naturalist and an inspiring communicator. The dynamic between her and her dad is fun. Jeremy includes her in his work, teaches her, but also learns from her, and makes science fun while connecting with her.
Ryan Tui recorded this conversation titled Father-Daughter Fieldwork, which Kelsey Skomberg produced.
My name is Jeremy Littell. My age is 44. I am a research ecologist for the Alaska Climate Science Center and the Department of Interior, U.S. Geological Survey. And my relationship to my partner is I'm her dad.
My name is Merity Littell. My age is 10. And my relationship to my partner is I'm his daughter. I work with my dad on my science projects. This year, we were trying to figure out if there was a wolverine at three points in the Campbell Tract that we got from a map that two people at Fish and Game, Mike Harrington and Dave Saalfeld, gave us. We got the points from where the wolverine was active most.
Yeah, so they collared her in 2012, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know if she's still there because they took the collar off. So they wanted to know if she was still there. Your wolverine had a name.
Route 66, because her tag number was 66.
Should we tell how you got started on this?
Oh, yeah. So I found my interest in wolverines when I saw two wolverines in the wild. Dad had been doing field work for 17 years and never seen a wolverine. On my first trip out there, bam, not one, but two wolverines in the wild.
We were up in the Chugach Front Range because we have a site there, too, for our treeline temperature work and that I share with Merity, and we always go every year to change out the sensors there. We had dropped our packs and had some food and then gone around behind some trees to put out some sensors. And while we were doing it, I thought, maybe that's not such a good idea to leave our packs behind. And I thought, well, at least I better go back and get the bear spray. And so she followed me back around the trees.
With a dog.
I saw this little brown face poking out through the grass, and my first thought was, there's the baby, where's the mother? And I grabbed Merity and I pulled her in, and I was like, okay, we better grab our things here and pay attention. And then I was like, well, wait a minute, that's not quite right. And then I saw, well, it's really low to the ground for a bear cub. And the more I looked, I thought, I know what that is. And then Merity saw it. We sat there and watched for a little bit, and then another one came through, and luckily, the wind was in our favor. I don't think they ever winded us. It wasn't even 50 yards. It was pretty special.
We're doing this project for the science fair, and we're also doing it for Fish and Game so that they can get information on what animals are living there. We started in late December and ended in late March. We were in Far North Bicentennial Park, which is a big place, but the points were spread out a lot.
Yeah, so these are all foothills of the Chugach. They're very popular places to run and ski and bike, but they also happen to have good animal habitat and be relatively accessible and interesting for the things that we're working on. How did we choose which transportation mode would get us there?
The snow conditions. So if the snow was really deep, we used snowshoes. When we were inexperienced, we just walked, and that did not work very well. If the conditions were good for biking, like not too deep snow, we would bike. And if they were too deep snow but not deep enough snow for snowshoeing, because walking would be too slow, we skied.
Your favorite way to get there was how?
Biking.
But it's a fat bike.
It's a fat bike, yeah.
4-inch tires riding on the snow.
Yeah.
When we got there, though, we parked the bikes in the woods and then walk into the actual field site. How'd you decide where we should put the cameras in the first place?
We decided that by where there was the most mustelid activity. A mustelid is a mammal that has musky scent glands. Some common mustelids are otters, skunks, and weasels. For camera one, we had in the general area found a lot of animal tracks. And the second one, we found a set of mustelid tracks going through this clearing. And so we decided to put a camera in there. That was actually the one that we did not get as many photos from. We only got like two from that one.
Yeah, it turns out that marten tracks that have been out there for a while and have some sun on them look an awful lot like wolverine tracks. And we were super excited for a while thinking, oh, we're going to see some wolverine evidence, right? But it turned out to be a marten, yeah.
A very large marten.
Yeah.
That peed all over everything.
Some traits are conserved among the whole mustelid family, right? You know, often when I participate with just me or with colleagues, it's a very different environment, different focus. When somebody's there learning, it's almost like time dilates a little bit. Things happen slower and you can kind of enjoy it more. There's not the pressure to generate tons and tons of data. There's not really any pressure. It's a much more fun environment in some ways. If we do another year of this, what would you change?
I would definitely want to include where we saw the wolverines because that would tell us if they were still there. Some reasons why they might be there would be that there are a lot of moose there, so that could lead to more moose carcasses because wolverines survive off carcasses. I participated in a science, technology, engineering, math competition where you had to invent something. And you didn't actually have to build it, but you had to explain it with documents. But we invented a drone with an infrared sensor that would sense fresh bodies of this kind of gross roadkill and pick them up with a claw and then carry them back to a truck, the roadkill people's truck.
And originally, I love this part of the design. Originally, the concept was also that it would keep that carrion from going to waste by turning it into edible food, right?
Yeah, and now it just picks up little things like squirrels because it would have been too hard to design to chop up like moose.
Maybe that's why we didn't find Route 66, if she got a hold of your drone.
Would be dead useful for you, for a wolverine.
Wolverine would love to have a carrion finding drone, right? Well, here's to many more science adventure outings.
Fieldwork is a funny thing for me. It's relief time where I can spend time in areas that I love. I have a relationship with the long-term field sites I manage. I know the trees, the layout of everything, and I see how things have changed over time. I've laid down a lot of memories out there, and I've worked through a lot of life things by having time to think. Now that I work with my husband in the field, we get to spend time together while getting work done in the forest. Fieldwork is also a little stressful, and not everything works out as planned, which we'll talk more about later in the show. Bob, what's memorable about fieldwork for you?
Well, I don't really enjoy the preparation part of going out in the field, but once I'm out of the house and at the field site, everything really changes for me. The part I enjoy most is being disconnected from my computer, email, and the internet for long periods of time, and I can just look and think uninterrupted. It's also a time where I'm able to learn from other people's perspectives as we drive to and from our field sites, or while digging a snow pit, or laughing over lunch while looking out over the Scenic River Valley. I forged a number of lifelong friendships while working in the field. It's definitely not always easy, but it's usually really rewarding. Also, Jesse, I think our friendship and collaboration is much more the result of us spending time in the field than in the office. Not that the office stuff is bad, but it's the times in the field that I really remember. Do you agree with that?
Oh yeah, I definitely agree with that. Going into the field gave us space to think about things, to talk, and to learn from each other.
I think the next conversation speaks well to this and is titled Lessons on Long Drives and Muddy Trails that Jesse Robertson recorded and Kelsey Skomberg produced.
My name is Katie Villano-Spellman. I am 36 years old, and I'm sitting here with my mentor and collaborator, Krista Mulder.
My name is Krista Mulder. I'm 49 years old, and the relationship to my partner is I am her current collaborator and former advisor twice over.
Krista, when did you first find me? Did I find you or did you find me?
We met each other in the greenhouse.
Oh, that's right.
You were washing samples.
And I just spent time working with two really hardcore ladies, and I was like, I want to be one of those hardcore ladies that drives a boat down the Tanana River and slogs through the mud all day and gathers samples.
I do remember that one of the main selling points on you was you were really tough in the field and you could stand, you know, slugging through the muck.
Yeah.
Which is an important quality in a grad student.
I knew coming in as a grad student that I didn't want to do science in a vacuum. I wanted it to be meaningful for people, and that helped keep my heart filled, you know, because you can get lost in the spreadsheets, and which I enjoy, but to know that getting lost in the spreadsheets is going to help somebody someday. You called me up when you got a giant grant, and you said, do you want to do the perfect project for you, for your PhD?
It was going to be some sort of training for educators, and then you came up with the idea of turning it into a citizen science project, and we spent about a week running around looking for different sites where we could put out these plots where we had lots of blueberries and cranberries. And I remember the time we went down the extremely little bushy road that scratched the side of our cars. I remember there was the guy who was like cutting logs there, and he said, oh, little ladies.
Yeah.
And he walked over to the side of the trail and he pulled down a birch tree and said, you guys just drive over this. Just don't tell your boss. And you ran, leaned out of the window and go, she is the boss. It's a $500,000 project.
But during those drives, because we spent a lot of time together driving,
yep,
to get to our sites, like that's when I think you did probably most of your like mentoring.
Well, I think it's a lot like parenting, really. You know, every kid is different and every graduate student is different. But when it works well, again, it's like watching your kids do better than you did at something. You know, like I watch my daughter bake cakes that are much, much better than anything I could possibly bake. And, you know, it makes you feel really good. So, you know, when you just got a big grant, that made me feel awesome. Because, like, yeah, look at what she just did.
Thanks, Krista. I'm taking notes because someday I'll have to mentor people, you know. And because my immediate reaction would be to invite people over to my house like you do, you know, mm-hmm. like we're going to start the field day with a fresh cup of coffee at my house.
I think the other thing is you're unusual because you came in already having a very strong sense of social justice and how important that was and how this was going to be part of what you were going to do. And I mean, it is, right? It's part of the citizen science work that you're doing now. It's melding science and education and social justice, particularly in rural villages. For me, I kept my scientific part of my life and my personal life very, very separate for a very long time. I mean, I've always been interested in child welfare, but it was a separate part of my life. And it's only now that I'm starting to fit those pieces together and say, hey, you know, maybe I can do that and can be a scientist and I can bring those two sets of talents together. And that's in part your influence because you've been doing that right from the start.
Wow, Krista. So. Oh, my gosh.
Thank you.
We've built each other's confidence and brought each other different skills. And
yep.
Yeah.
And we have complementary skills. I think that's why we're still, you know, what, we counted them yesterday or the day before. We were still working on four projects together.
Collaborators for life, Krista.
That's right. You know, I mean, some of the other things that I'm doing, like my involvement in the fostering science program where we're working with kids in foster care. And we think about kids in foster care because they often don't have any opportunities to participate in summer programs, especially once they get about age 12 or so, because when you're 5 years old, you don't need to have any skills to go to a camp. But by the time you get 13, 14, 15 years old, you actually need to have some background usually in the type of camp you go to. And so we thought, well, what if we had a camp for kids and it's sort of a science education / adventure camp? It's really a lot of natural history is what it turned into this summer. And one of the things that emerged too was that each kid sort of found one area that they were particularly interested in, whether that was trapping animals, or one kid got really excited about soils. But it was really cool to see each one of them go, oh, this is something I'm really interested in, I can do.
And to know that science isn't something that you just have to memorize and that you feel like you're not good at in a large classroom setting, but to be like, this is science and this is awesome. Like the same things that sparked us. Like, I want to be one of those ladies that's dirty every day and slugging through places without trails and people as real people, scientists as real people, and that care about them, you know? Krista, I want to thank you for being my mentor since the year 2005, right?
I think that's right. Yeah, it's been a long time. Well, thank you for being part of my life for that entire time as well.
Yeah.
Plus, I've got to watching your kids grow up. They're going to be part of my life.
Yeah.
Your husband.
Here's so many more years of collaboration, Krista. We're high-fiving.
We're high-fiving.
When I listen to that conversation, I think about how it's not only about fieldwork, but also the importance of mentorship. Jesse, in your experience, what do you think are the qualities of a good mentor?
The two mentorship experiences I've had that come to mind are when I was a postdoc in Wyoming. One mentor taught me how to find the possibility in every data set, no matter how small or fragmented. It was like learning to look for gold in something that just felt like mud. Another mentor taught me about collegiality and finding the positive, because I've always struggled with the negative in this field. He said it's better to lift people up and be inclusive.
Mentorships can also evolve into friendships, and strong relationships are an important part of life. Science and fieldwork can build relationships when we're inclusive of people who live and work in the places we study. They know more about the systems than we do, after all. I think scientists can come across in negative or silly ways at times, as we'll hear in our next story.
I think that's why I really like the next conversation between Lance and Ryan. Ryan's work has taken him to many rural villages throughout Alaska. One of those places is Vinatai, where he met Lance. Lance works with researchers, but also communicates knowledge and information to the different communities in which he works. When I recorded this conversation, I was struck by how much I learned in the short 40 minutes that they shared. They also made me laugh.
Jesse Robertson recorded the following conversation titled, Keeping an Eye on the Land, which Kelsey Skomberg produced.
My name is Lance Whitwell. I'm 53 years old, and my relationship to Ryan is friend and colleague.
My name is Ryan Tui. My age is 40 years old. And yeah, my relationship to Lance is a friend, collaborator, colleague. Well, hey, Lance, thanks for doing this today. I think you had an actual story to kind of maybe kick this off with.
All right. Well, we can do that. I guess when you first approached me about this, it was something to do with the collaboration of traditional ecological knowledge mixed with the science. And I have had a couple of experiences with scientists in the field. A few of them seem to be a little bit funny. So I was a jet boat pilot working with U.S. Fish and Wildlife crew one time. We were doing salmon habitat studies, and they had left some data collectors in the river channel to collect temperature and things like that. And they wanted to come back toward the springtime with snow machines and come up the river to retrieve the data collectors. And so we had a strategy meeting, and we were sitting there most of one evening. Of course, it was summer when we were thinking about it, but they had their GPS gear out, and we were plotting courses for them to come back in the winter and retrieve these data collectors. And we got almost done, and one of the local guys stopped by with a boat, and we asked him, if it was you coming up this river, which way would you go? And he pointed across the river and said, there's a road from the village to right there. I'll come up the road and just cross the river once. There was my experience working with NASA and the University of Alaska Poker Flats Research Range. They shoot rockets over our community to gather data from the Northern Lights. And occasionally the rocket motors will land on our tribal land, and we help them recover and things like that. They brought all their cameras and stuff up to my office, and, you know, we were working real time just over Skype, and the scientists were in Fairbanks, and they were monitoring what was going on there, and I was turning out, you know, I had all the cameras and stuff on in my office in Venetoy, and just kind of watching it, and we're communicating back and forth, and the weather's got to be perfect in Fairbanks and in Venetoy at the same time so that everything gets captured at once. And I was sitting there one night about 3 a.m, and the Northern Lights, a big wave of Northern Lights came through, and I got on Skype, and I told these guys and the scientists in Fairbanks, it's good, shoot it. And they said, oh, we already fired it off about 10 minutes ago. And I said, what? I thought you guys were waiting for me to give you the signal. And they're like, no, truthfully, we just need you to turn the camera on at 8 o'clock. That was my NASA experience. You know, I thought I was an integral part of their program, and really I was just a switch operator, I guess.
Can you describe the kind of like what Venetoy is like what the landscape's like a little bit, and the culture too?
Well, it's Squitchin Athabascan community. Venetoy itself in a lower area. It's in the Yukon Flats area, they call it. Kind of a boreal type of forest. We've got some big trees, but we have a lot of little trees and a lot of bushes, a lot of hardwoods, cottonwoods, poplars. A lot of animals, really. We get caribou that migrate through. We've got moose, bears, wolves, things like that. It's really hard to get around that country, especially in the winter. And it's nice, quiet, mostly a subsistence kind of life. We get salmon. It's a big part of our subsistence life. Then I also serve the northern part of our tribal lands, the community called Arctic Village, and it's a little bit higher up into the Brooks Range. It's more of a tundra type of a setting. Still boreal, but the trees seem to be a lot smaller there and a little bit sparse. Venetoy tribal government owns 1.8 million acres of what used to be a reservation until ANCSA. That comprises both of the communities that I work with, but I also try to take care of all the land in between. The tribal land is almost totally encompassed by wildlife refuges. We've got the Arctic Refuge to the north, and we've got the Yukon Flats Refuge to the south. The river's a major navigation source for us. It's very shallow, it's very tricky to drive, which is really good because that keeps other people out
right.
Most of the time, you know. And so it's mostly just locals that you'll find on the river.
That's the channeler, right?
Yeah, we formed a tribal water and soil conservation district. The Chandler River was actually formally changed. The name has changed to Tadrinjik now.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Great. Oh, wow. Fantastic.
So it's gone back to its native name. And so I've been the IGAP coordinator since 1998, done a little bit of everything you can imagine, from recycling pop cans to, you know, fuel spill response and contaminated site cleanups and brownfields and the whole gamut of things that we can run into in the villages. It's really paid off. I can really see a difference, not only in the communities that I serve, but in the other villages also.
That's awesome.
To where things are really getting cleaned up. Of course, you know, the Yukon Watershed Council has been instrumental in getting a lot of these programs going and sustaining them through the years. And I've worked quite a few years with yourself and the Watershed Council on doing water sampling and doing water quality monitoring type of things. It's really, really good. And the people at home are really glad that we're doing it. We've got some major mining that is starting to occur upriver from us. So we're really worried about the water quality, and we're really keeping a good eye on it. And so far, it's been all right.
Venetoy is one of my most favorite places to come out to, and part of that's because of you, but the community in general has always been really great. It's neat to hear that the community has gotten more interested in the mine, but also that we've been taking that water quality data for how long has that been now?
Like about
10 years, I mean.
Yeah, at least.
So that's an incredible kind of baseline to be able to look at and look for changes. Thanks, Lance. As always, I learned a ton. And I hope we keep to get talking for many, many years to come.
Well, absolutely. Glad to be here. Thanks for offering.
We often get to work in some really remarkable and special places. Our next conversation is a great example of this and takes place during a long river trip in northern Alaska. Naomi describes it much better than I do, but it's these types of experiences that I'm very much missing now as COVID-19 is keeping me from my field sites out on the Seward Peninsula. I recorded the following conversation titled Encountering Caribou and a Bear Before Breakfast, which Kelsey Skomberg produced.
My name is Rebecca Lawhorn. I'm 27 years old, and I'm here with my best friend, Naomi O'Neill.
Hi, my name's Naomi O'Neill. I'm 30 years old, and I'm talking to my best friend, Rebecca Lawhorn.
Okay, I want to know the craziest thing that's ever happened to you out in the field, like the scariest thing and the funniest thing.
The scariest thing was probably like when a bear walked up when I was brushing my teeth. On a river.
Is this the float trip that you did?
Yeah. Float trip from Itivaluk River down to Nuiqsut. Or up, I guess. I had just woken up. I always woke up first. I don't know why. But it was the end of August, I think. The last couple weeks of August. The willow were starting to turn yellow and the tundra was kind of getting more and more red every day. And the whole trip took about 3 weeks. So over the progression of those 3 weeks, kind of got to see fall take over. And it turns really fast. It seems like there was only maybe a week where there were a lot of colors, and then the leaves were gone, and it was snowing the last couple of days that we were there. We were on the Colville River, probably 200 or so miles upriver from Nuiqsut, Alaska. And we were camped in a little willow alder thicket just to get out of the wind. It's pretty windy up there. There's probably 150 yards of gravel between the river and where the brush started. And it was 6 or 7 in the morning. And I woke up because caribou were crossing the river. And when caribou hooves in gravel makes a lot of noise. And then, of course, their hooves in water is like, kuk-plunk, kuk-plunk. And so I thought, oh, I'll just get up and see those caribou and walk down to our boats that were right off the river. We stored all our food down there so it would be away from our campsite. Then I heard the gravel rustling. And I turned and I thought, oh, more caribou, you know. Nope, that's not a caribou, that's a bear. And it just kept walking towards me, just zero fear, but also not aggressive. So I wasn't too scared and I had means of protection. So,
what do you mean when you say not aggressive? Like it's just kind
you
of
you know
like
when
bumbling.
A dog growls at you and has its ears back.
Hmm. Do bears do that? Do they put their ears back?
They put their ears back, yeah. Hmm. Or you can tell like they have their hair stands up on their back. But it wasn't aggressive. It was just curious, which scared me more because I was like, what are you going to do? But it was just like lumberly, like do-do-do-do-do, just walking on the river. Just didn't really care about me at all. I was screaming, you know, get out of here, hey! And I yelled at the two other people that were with me, and they thought I was joking, of course.
Yeah,
and I was like,
why?
This is
why
not something I would joke about.
Why would they think you were joking? Because you always play practical jokes on people?
Not about bears.
Mm-hmm. Is that where you draw the line?
That's where I draw the line, my personal safety. Mm-hmm. But they came down, made a bunch of noise, didn't really affect the bear at all. One girl just kept telling me to shoot it. And in my brain, I was thinking, no way. I don't want to shoot this bear, because if you shoot a bear in self-defense, you have to take the hide and the paws and the head with you. And we still had maybe two or so more weeks of floating this river.
So you would have just been dragging that bear along.
Yeah, probably attracting more bears. But anyway, it decided to go somewhere else after a while. Mm-hmm. It wasn't super scary for me. I was more uneasy by the fact that my voice, you know, identifying that I wasn't a caribou, wasn't enough for it to walk away. Like normally bears are curious and they sit down and they watch you. They don't really approach you. Most of the time, if you yell like, "Hey bear," or anything, that startles them and they run. Like, not every bear, but I would say 90% of bears that I've seen, it was their butt running away. You know, they don't want to really have anything to do with you once they figure out that you're not a caribou or something that they really want to deal with. They're out of there. Oh, that same trip, that river trip, I was sleeping in my tent and it was snowing. You know, snow makes a whoop sound when it breaks away from something. And I woke up to that sound, like, whoop. And I thought it was a bear because they kind of make that noise. They like whoop at you sometimes, mm-hmm. especially sows with cubs. That's how they like call their cubs back to them. And I woke up and my feet feel pinned. So I was like, what's going on? Because I didn't realize it was snowing that hard that it collapsed one side of my tent. It was on my legs. I thought there was a bear on my legs. I laughed at myself. No one else got it, but that was pretty cool.
Bear just sitting on your legs.
It happens, you know.
Does it? Does it happen?
I've heard stories.
It's been good talking to you.
Yeah. It's been great talking to you, too.
Not all field work goes as planned. We've all had experiences in the field that test our patience, our abilities, and our limits. These are definitely times of personal growth.
The next conversation is one I had with Kristen about being resilient in this challenging field. We consider the role of choice in our lives and what it means to be resilient to stress. We also talk about a class I taught with some colleagues on how to navigate interpersonal relationships and science careers. Kristen was a student in this class, and the purpose behind it was to provide some mentorship for grad students in navigating their inner experiences and challenging situations that are sometimes part of the science culture. She's since graduated, and I have no doubt that she'll be a fantastic role model for others in her science career.
Jesse Robertson recorded the following conversation, and it's titled Uneven Ground, Permafrost Thaw, and Burnout, which Kelsey Skumberg produced.
My name is Jesse Robertson. I'm 39 years old, and I'm talking to Kristen, and she's a student in my class.
My name is Kristen Gagne. I am 24 years old, and I'm talking to Jesse, my professor.
So I just wanted to start with, what are you doing here at UAF?
So I'm here at UAF doing my PhD in environmental chemistry. I do a lot of field work, and I'm glad that I'm not out there today because it's a little cold today.
So you do it in the winter, too?
I do it in the winter, and everybody's like, you go on frozen lakes in the winter? I'm like, yeah, I got frostbite once because I was on a frozen lake in the wintertime, and it was minus 20. So I came up here kind of not knowing what I was getting myself into, and it's been interesting, very interesting.
Like in what way? Like if you're going to paint a picture in pretty simple terms?
The normal way to figure out if there's permafrost underneath water is really expensive, and so we're trying to figure out if there's a tracer to the permafrost, how does that influence the organic matter in the surface water, which feeds the microbes that we see and stuff like that.
Is the work as exciting as you thought it would be?
The hydrology of the area is definitely way more interesting than we were anticipating, and so what we thought was going to be straightforward actually isn't, and I guess that's the definition of science. It's not going to be easy.
Grad school is sort of an interesting time. It's not always what people thought it would be or expected it would be. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Before, when I came in, I was very like, oh, I have to do this, I have to do that. Now it's more like I'm getting more comfortable with change. Not fully there yet. I don't like when all of a sudden, oh, you have to do this instead. I'm like, oh, but I was doing this. So it's allowing me to grow in who I am and definitely allowing me to become less anxious and more ready for change than I used to be. A lot of people who I came in with are like, oh, yeah, I know what I'm doing. And I'm like, I don't know if that's what you're saying, you know, or whether that's actually how you feel, because I know I feel like I'm trudging through the snow trying to figure out what I'm doing and like how to make it all work.
So what has science been like for you?
It's been good that I've had all these opportunities. People do come to me for like, oh, you should go do this, you should do that, or what about this? But I'm having trouble with people coming to me and saying, oh, help me, help my grad student, help my undergrad. And I start asking other grad students if they ever felt this way. And one who has graduated, she's like, oh, yeah, you just took my spot. And I was like, thanks for warning me. I'm now learning to say no because of your class. And so I've started saying no to some things, and it's definitely lessened my plate. But I can tell that people really rely on me, and I'm like, you shouldn't be relying on me. I have other things I need to do.
I'm curious if there's anything that's come out of the class that you're surprised by.
I like to see the advisor's point of view. When you're talking about being a hands-off advisor, I was having trouble having a hands-off advisor. And when you talked about how and why you are hands-off, I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense. Okay, this is a learning experience. They know I can do it. That's why they're hands-off. So I definitely think that was a surprise that I wasn't expecting, and it was a good surprise. Another thing that I also found surprised, when we were talking about priorities and boundaries and how I'm constantly working and other grad students aren't, and it bothers me that they're not working, but yet I feel like I can't not work. I was having trouble figuring out what my priorities were, and I guess my priority is 5 years. And so now when I'm like overworking and I feel like very bogged down in work, I'm like, 5 years. That's all. 5 years. And then I feel better.
So much of the job is about managing failure. And the more positive side of people's brains would say, oh, no, 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 or these are learning opportunities or whatever. But at some point, it's actually just failure. So I had one summer that by the end of the summer, I was like, that's it. I quit. I'm quitting science forever. This can like lay down and die, which is that summer I got a couple of small grants. One was to work in Grand Teton National Park, and one was to got a travel grant to come to Alaska. And they sent me all the way to Kantishna because they're like, oh, there's permafrost in there. You can go in there and work. And you dig about 25 centimeters down and all it is rocks. While we were at Kantishna, I was there with a couple folks. Our bear spray exploded. We all got maced. All of our stuff got covered in the capsaicin oil. It was awful. This is the first time I had to like really bark out orders to people. I was like, we're getting back on the bus and we're going to leave the park and we're going to finish this project and we're going to get the hell out of here. And on the drive out, I had like some bodily meltdown. I felt like I was having, I don't know what, I thought I was having a stroke or something. Like I couldn't move my hands. I couldn't move my feet. The sensation was moving on my arms. So they called an ambulance, and so I left the park in an ambulance, and then I spent the night sleeping on the floor of somebody's office. But I had science brain, which was just like, we got to keep going, we got to keep going. But what I realized is I was exhausted. Like, I hadn't slept much in 6 weeks. I'd had a disastrous trip to the Tetons to collect samples, which I think is why I finally had a meltdown. I'm curious, in your graduate work, any failures that have happened? How did you manage it? How did you feel about it?
Well, I'm terrible with failure. I've had a few setbacks, and it gets me really upset to where I don't want to work. But then give me a few days to recharge, and then I'm like, okay, well, now I'm going to go try this, and I get super excited about something.
So I came out of undergrad like a pretty confident person. Like, I was a class valedictorian. I'd worked 3 jobs. And then I went into grad school, and I don't think I handled the fluidity of it as well as it sounds like you're handling it. But the failures, you know what it felt like? Is like, you know when you're walking across crusty snow and you post hole? And you're like, and you're like up to your thigh. You're like, so then you have to be trying to push yourself out and you kind of like walk tentatively and then you post hole again. And that's really what it started to feel like. And so part of the impetus for putting this class together was, like, I guess I wanted people to know, like, you have a choice, even when it feels like you don't. And if people want to choose to give it all, everything to their career, that's great. But some people don't feel like there's a choice, and there is. And people think that you have to lay it all down at the altar to be successful? And I just don't think so. With the class too, I know that we've shared a lot of experiences that appear to be negative in some ways, but in other ways, I hope that we can also show like the resilience of people, no matter what you choose. And resilience can mean moving into a different profession. Resilience can mean refocusing on your profession. Resilience can mean building community. You know, it can mean a lot of things.
And although we talk about a lot of negative things, it also makes you know you're not alone.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking.
Thank you.
What's been on your mind since that conversation with Kristen?
I've thought a lot about the science culture and how challenging it can be if we don't actively set boundaries with our work. Work can easily spill over to all parts of our lives. And that's what I pointed out to the students in my class. You can set boundaries with your science work and still be successful. And you might even be more successful because your life is a little more balanced. I've certainly found that for myself. So, Bob, please share your thoughts about what it means to work in the field throughout Alaska.
Well, being in the field can mean a lot of different things. It can mean working on a glacier, hiking across bountiful tundra, or navigating a winding river. It is possible to go weeks or months away from home without seeing your family or friends, or even sleeping in your own bed. Over the last number of years, I've spent a lot of time working on traditional lands. During these times away, it's easy to forget that we're sharing these places. We continually need to remind ourselves we are guests and that it is a privilege that we are allowed to conduct our work on these traditional lands.
We often broadly refer to going out into the field as traveling to some remote place away from campus or from our homes. And sometimes visiting nature and visiting the field means returning home. I think this next conversation perfectly describes this. Tanya describes working with the land, farming to grow food, and sharing and connecting with her community.
I recorded the following conversation titled Tionic Grown, Sharing Harvest and Heritage, which Kelsey Skomberg produced.
My name is Krista Herringa. I am 31 years old, and I am a fellow farmer of Tanya, who I will be interviewing today.
I'm Tanya Koloa, and I'm 30 years old, and I am being interviewed by a fellow farmer, Krista.
Well, Tanya, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind starting today telling me a little bit about yourself and your family, where you're from.
I grew up in an Athabaskan village in Alaska on the west side of the Cook Inlet, which is about 47 miles northwest outside of Anchorage. Being from Tionic is a good natural land to be from. It's very pristine. And growing up out there, it rose a question in my mind as a young kid as to why we're not growing foods, why we don't farm, question my culture. I would hear my father talk about his grandmother or his dad, who were also from Tionic. And it felt very passionate with culture. And I just wondered where it went and why we're not so connected to the earth. I was not able to identify plants out there. I was not able to identify the trees in my own backyard. I was a teenager when I started learning my history. I am a mixed native, as they call it. On my father's side, I am Athabaskan Hawaiian, Haida Shimshian. On my mother's side, I'm Aleut, Lakota, Ponca, and Modoc Indian. And when I found that out, I just had that connection to wanting to know who I am and why we were put on this land. A lot of those questions as a young kid was very hard because I grew up with an alcoholic family. My household was very dysfunctional, had a lot of domestic violence in there. Going back one more generation, Alexandra Stefan Koloa, Athabaskan, originally from Custatan, moved to Tionic. She is the one who grew the garden for the people enough to feed villagers, and at that time TB was going around, flu was killing people, bad waters, and people started to migrate to Tyonik from Susitna Station, from Kenai, from Nundalton. It touches my heart very deeply to know that my grandmother grew a garden in Tyonik in the early 1900s. And here I am on the same land, trying to bring back that knowledge and to share it with the youth and to get them involved. I don't think climate change is something we should just wait off until a disaster. I think we just need to be more prepped and figure out, like, how far ahead could we get our stock up, our vegetables up for a year worth supply? Could we do that on our own as opposed to always shipping food out to the villages?
Tanya, could you describe the farm operation? Like, what's on the farm and who works with you and how did that all come together?
Yes, the farm. I brought my family, my boyfriend and our son down to the village, and I noticed there was a big patch of land that was just cleared. I asked my friend, hey, why is that patch of land cleared? Are they going to build a new building? And she said, oh, the village, they want to do a garden over there. And I looked at her and I said, oh my gosh, they're going to do a garden. That's a lot of land they cleared. Who's going to take care of it? Jeez. And 2 years later, I was helping run it. My biggest gift to that was to involve the youth. Our organization is based out in Anchorage, so when we got the garden going, we needed people on ground to be able to check water temps or make sure the fans are going in our high tunnels. And when the youth got there, I said, hey, this is your land for one, your tribe, your grandparents made this. And they're looking at me like an outsider, because none of these children know me. And I said, excuse me, no disrespect. I know your mom. I know your grandparents. So let's make it clear. I'm a tribal member. I'm not an outsider. And I don't know anything. But I know our tribe wants this. And what they did was made an organization, a tribal conservation district, which I work for. And so I kind of make that clear connection as to things I'm doing, why I'm doing it. As a kid, I felt in the dark. I didn't know what my tribe was. I didn't know what a tribal council was. I didn't know anything about meetings. So I still relay everything I've been taught and grew up with, and I share it with them. And I say, it is important to your grandparents. They put it on a piece of paper and signed it to say, this is important. We want to go forth with it. But do you, as a tribal member, think this is important? To get them thinking, what do I have to give back? In the communities, I feel like a lot of the youth exposure for adults are outsiders because of the school districts. And so for a tribal member to come back and say, hey, you guys remember the garden? It's almost that time. They're like, Tanya, she's back. And so it's just reminding them, this is a great gift. This is something our grandparents gave to us. My elders, they talk about their elders. And I say to my elders, they ate vegetables. The elders are saying, no, I don't like that. No, I don't eat that. And I look at them and I say, you eat your vegetables. And it's a culture shock because I feel as if I'm not entitled to talk to them in that manner. But yet, I have worked my butt off in the sun and in the rain and in stormy days and flew over on an airplane to grow your food. And I'm going to cook up some fresh veggies and sneak it in your food, and you're going to love it. I grew up on canned food. I honestly didn't know what a green bean looked like until I grew it. And I still didn't believe anybody was a green bean until they cut it. So being able to just look at my tribal youth and say, you know what, I don't know a dime about this, but hey, let's grab the seed together. Mm-hmm. Let's put it in our earth and let's water it with our water. And let's just hope it comes back. We're going to come back and nurture it. We're going to defend it because we want it to feed us.
Well, thank you, Tanya, for sharing your story and passion for farming and gardening, what it means to you, and especially what it means to your community and tribe.
Thanks for being here and putting this together and inviting me to be with you, Krista.
We feature several more stories about fieldwork on our website at alaskavoices.org. I particularly like the conversation between Serena and Megan. In their conversation, I like how they describe their process of developing trust and relationships in a rural community. It was a process that took time and definitely was not a smooth ride. Over time, I think they were able to develop the trust they were originally seeking and were able to build that bridge to understanding, which sometimes just means listening for a while.
In our next episode of Alaska Voices, we'll be focusing on understanding our future by remembering our shared past. I will leave you with a short preview of the conversation between Sam and Luke.
Once you take away land, I mean, geography is everything. I mean, it's history, it's oral tradition, it's everything. It's that rock over there means this, that means this, that means this. As I've seen in every single community that I've been to, when communities are grounded in their culture, they have lower rates of incarceration, lower rates of alcoholism, lower rates of drug abuse, lower rates of sexual trauma. What we see climate change doing is we see the culture being pulled out of these communities.
And cultural history of people's moving in the United States is not the most positive.
Yeah.
It's devastating. We don't want it to be that way when, you know, our Alaskan communities have to relocate.
Alaska Voices builds bridges by creating a space where community members, friends, policymakers, and scientists can share stories and place-based knowledge. This project was developed in partnership with StoryCorps and was funded by the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center. Additional funding was provided by the University of Alaska Fairbanks Chancellor through a generous gift from the Bentley Family Trust. Alaska Voices would not be possible without the help and efforts of an amazing group of people. Our producer and audio engineer is Kelsey Skomberg of Mossy Stone Media. Our podcast and outreach specialist is Michael DeLue. And our website designer is Carolyn Rosner.
We also want to thank the musicians whose songs we heard today. Arctic Evening by Marcel Duprise, Lafayette Instrumental by Josh Woodward, Rewound and I Don't See the Branches, I See the Leaves by Chris Zabriskie, Wind on My Legs by Mon Plaisir, Hollow Poplar and Frog in the Well by Lucas Gans, Du L'Herbe Sous les Pieds by Komiku, Somewhere Nice by John Bartman, The Beauty of Maths and Interplanetary Forest by Maiden, Dilemma by Niall Law.
If you are interested in more conversations or information, please visit our website at alaskavoices.org.
For Alaska Voices, I'm Jesse Robertson.
And I'm Bob Bolton.